shed.
Hello, and welcome to day 13 of the Cosmic Shed Advent Calendar. Let's see who's behind the door.
Behind the door today we have Dr. Karen Meach. Now, Karen Meach is the person who you call if you've found an interstellar rock flying through our solar system. We've talked about Oumuamua a little bit on the podcast before, particularly in our episode on First Man before we embarked on this Advent calendar malarkey. And we heard from Avi Loeb, the Harvard professor of astronomy, who famously caused the headlines which suggested that Oumuamua might be an alien spacecraft, or bit of an alien spacecraft, or alien solar sail broken off in some alien battle. We also heard from Andreas Heim of Project Lyra a study of how we might send a mission to Oumuamua. But Karen Meach is the joint author of some of the most important papers on Oumuamua. And Oumuamua was spotted by the Pan-STARRS telescope in October 2017 and was quickly discovered to have been possibly an asteroid, possibly a comet, or possibly something else, but certainly it had come from interstellar space. Its origin is not from our solar system. When it was discovered, as I say, astronomers in Hawaii called their colleague, also in Hawaii, Karen Meach, and this is how the discovery went from her point of view.
Well, when it was discovered by the Pan-STARRS survey on the 19th, it took them a couple days to realize that this really was interesting because you had to get a good enough orbit. And so on the 22nd, which was a Sunday of October, Richard Wainscote, who's the head of the Pan-STARRS Near Earth Object Survey Program, called me at home and said, I think we really do have an interstellar object. And he contacted me because I'm a planetary observer, I'm a comet specialist, and I've led huge observing campaigns for space missions. So I really do have all the connections to very rapidly get the resources. So you know, my first thought was, did it really have to be today? Because it was Sunday. I had just gotten back from the big Division for Planetary Sciences meeting the Saturday, the day before, and it had been months since I'd had a day off at all. So I was really looking forward to doing nothing. So I thought, man, why today? But then, you know, it's very exciting. And so we immediately leaped into writing telescope proposals. So within a period, so that was Sunday. Wrote some proposals for the Very Large Telescope in Chile, Gemini South in Chile. The Very Large Telescope proposal was approved within hours. Gemini, I think it took another day. We wrote HS Hubble Space Telescope proposals to UKIRT, basically everything on Mauna Kea. And at the same time, we're starting to prepare the observations we're observing. We're reducing the data. And on Monday, the 23rd, I contacted Nature editor Leslie Sage and said, here's what the discovery is. Are you going to want the paper? And he just said, yes. Now, normally it's quite a bit of fighting and negotiation to get Leslie to agree that it might be something of interest to Nature, but he just said yes. And so by the following Saturday, that was our last night of observing because it was getting too faint. And the following Monday, we submitted our paper. So it was pretty much live in the office. I was coordinating everyone, getting the paper written and submitted.
What's the atmosphere like in the office?
And it was exciting, but in our minds, it's an interstellar comet. And so as the observations come back, we're just treating it like another comet, although very quickly we saw that there was no activity. So we were a bit surprised, thinking, oh, wow, it actually has no cometary activity. So, you know, that was of interest, but you're so focused on this multitasking to both continue to write your observing proposals and analyze the data that it was exciting, but there was also tremendous pressure because you knew everybody was scrambling to get data and to do their own analysis, and everybody wanted to be out first. It's pronounced Oumuamua. People who proposed the name suggested a definition of scout or messenger from the distant past reaching out to us. the first visitor to our solar system from another star system that we've discovered. And we gave them about 3 days. In fact, I think we contacted them on a Friday and said, if possible, we'd like it by Sunday, because we were hoping to submit the paper on Monday and then have the name in the paper. And they did indeed just take a couple days to do it. But then we realized, and I should have known better because I've been the president of one of the International Astronomical Union divisions, that that's not the way the IAU works. You've got to get approval for names. And usually that's a long, slow process. So we requested approval for the name on Monday. And to my surprise, the IAU worked very fast, and we had the okay a week later.
Who did you ask the name?
Two locals in Hawaii, Kai Kimura and Larry Kimura. Larry was a linguist and Kai's a Polynesian navigator.
In your TED talk, which I loved as well, you said that it was initially going to be called Rama, but you changed the name. Why did you change it from Rama?
The first name was a catalog name that was really unwieldy, you know, P10EEV5, and that was hard to type. And then it kept getting its name changed as the Minor Planet Center got more data and reclassified it. But even so, I was trying to manage coordinating a lot of people to get telescope time, and all of these things were hard to type. So we got to have something easier to type. And so we called it, I forget who it was, said, oh, let's call it Rama, because of the Arthur C. Clarke science fiction story. Yeah. But on the team said, no, I don't like that. And, you know, then there was a movement that we really ought to go for something meaningful to Hawaii. Until we got a name, we just were calling it U1, because that was much easier to type then.
Yeah, because I think it's the first thing that came into everybody who's ever read Rendezvous with Rama's Head, right, when this object was discovered. That's the first thing that jumps into. Had you read the book before?
So just recently, traveling to Paris on my recent trip, I reread it, and it was very interesting. Is that many of the similarities with the discovery, but on the other hand, what was funny in the book was the poor fellow who discovered it was having trouble getting telescope time to follow it up. I thought, well, that certainly didn't happen here.
Yeah, it's a while since I read it, but with Avi Loeb's paper a couple of weeks ago, it sort of brought that back home again. What did you think when you saw that paper?
I was furious because, for several reasons, the science part of it, up until his wild, crazy, unreasonable speculations at the end, the science part of it, while thorough, was not new. Our Nature paper, led by Marco Michelli, that was published on June 27th of this year, had already talked about solar radiation pressure. And, you know, we'd gone through the argument, but of course, in a Nature paper, you can't lay out all the math like Avi did, so he was more thorough. We said it could be solar radiation pressure, but you'd have to make unreasonable assumptions. You'd have to assume it's 10,000 times less dense than a comet, or that it would be a thin sheet of material, both of which are not plausible. And so we rejected that. And then we had about, I think, six or seven other alternative reasons that you could get an acceleration. And we systematically went through and rejected all of them, because either the acceleration that those mechanisms would produce was way too low or in the wrong direction. So the only thing that was left was comet activity. And just because we didn't see the comet activity doesn't mean it's not there. You know, we expected, you know, comet activity that would give you enough push for this acceleration would either be gas or dust coming off. And a normal comet has lots of tiny dust and big dust. And so we had estimated from our images that there was really no tiny dust at all near the nucleus. I think our limit was a kilogram within 750 kilometers. That's a tiny amount. On the other hand, if it's big dust, you know, big in terms of millimeters or bigger, it takes a lot of gas to push that off. And so even with a lot of gas, you're not going to get much dust. And plus, at the wavelengths we were observing, we weren't sensitive to millimeter-sized dust. So we wouldn't have seen it. And there have been papers published in the past that said speculated that an interstellar comet passing through space, if it ever passed through a molecular cloud, that would erode the small dust. So to us, that didn't seem unreasonable. And we certainly have examples of things in our solar system that don't have small dust. Have you seen the images of the asteroid Ryugu from the Hayabusa mission? It's bizarre looking. It's just completely rocky. There is no dust on the surface. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that with the observations, there had been a couple people that had tried to get spectra of Oumuamua. And one person's spectra got far enough into the blue that the typical thing that we usually look for in comets is cyanide, CN. And not that it's very abundant in comets, it's about 1% or so. It's just that it emits light very easily. So that's the first thing that people always see. And he didn't detect any, but his spectrum was really noisy. So the amount of water that we thought would have to come off of Oumuamua in order to give it this push, if it had normal comet abundances, we should have seen cyanide. So this means that the chemistry is different, but that's not really a surprise either. It's coming from another solar system. So still, the most plausible way to have this push was comet activity. So Avi, you know, went through all the math and then went to the most unreasonable, exotic explanation with no proof whatsoever. He had some other calculations in the paper, which had already been done by other people also. So, you know, given that you're making an extraordinary claim, you better have extraordinary evidence. And he had no evidence whatsoever. And so, yeah, I'm upset that the referees let it through from the point of view of there wasn't new stuff there. And then secondly, this was a reputable science journal. And I'm wondering about their refereeing process now, if they're going to let this sort of thing through.
Oh, interesting.
Yep, like a true nerd, I've been charting the progress of my TED talk as time went on. Oh my gosh, when his paper was released, yeah, it had been sort of a slow rise. Now it's skyrocketing.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah. Although you wish it would skyrocket from the pure science point of view.
Yeah, yeah. But you're putting the other message out there, you know, and I think that's, I mean, certainly in my article, what you've just said is going to be there, so there'll be that balance. So, you know, if it does attract, it's a tough one. I'm trying to work out with it. From the public point of view, does him saying that make people think it is aliens, or does it make people go, really? And then look at it in more depth. And I'd like to think it makes them look at it in more depth, but I'm probably being naive.
You know, the more scientifically inclined people are critical of his work. And, you know, even my sister, she's a medical doctor. She called me and said, you won't believe what they've got on the morning news. And the newscasters on TV were kind of making fun of it. So there will be critique, but on the other hand, people that aren't so scientifically inclined, that, you know, there's a lot of people, myself included, that would just love to find life elsewhere. And so this is intriguing. And the sad thing is, because he's from Harvard, just because of that, people think it must be true. And so I think he's done science a bit of disservice by making such a firm statement. I heard from the referee of our Nature paper that because of the one sentence in the part where we said why we were rejecting solar radiation pressure, that it would imply a thin shell or thin sheet of material, the editor almost didn't accept our paper. And we weren't claiming aliens. We were just saying those would be the conditions under which the physics would work.
Were you part of the decision to point radio telescopes at it, the SETI, from a SETI angle?
Oh, I was totally supportive of that. You know, it's the first time something like this has entered the solar system. It's an interesting experiment. It's easy to do. It's inexpensive. So why wouldn't you do it? And in addition, the Green Bank Telescope, in addition to just listening for a radio signal that could be deemed intelligent, they were also doing science because they were also trying to get an upper limit on water outgassing, because those frequencies could detect water directly. And so they actually produced some science with a real upper limit on the outgassing. The upper limit wasn't particularly sensitive. Their upper limit was about a factor of 100 higher than the amount of gas we needed to push Oumuamua, but still, it's a piece of scientific data that we now have in hand.
So there's Project Lyra.
Yeah. One of the things that's gotten me very upset about this whole process is the race by everybody in the community to slap their papers onto the astronomy archive before they are accepted by any journals. And in fact, some of the papers were never submitted to journals. And as far as I know, I did look at the Project Lyra paper a while back. I haven't looked at it recently. That was never published, as far as I could tell.
But as a concept of trying to get to it, how workable do you think that is?
When we first heard about it, I talked to one of the folks at JPL, and he was intrigued enough. He said, well, I'll spend a little money and put one of my lead mission designers on it to see if technologically it would be possible to get to Oumuamua. And their work showed that you could actually get to Oumuamua, but it would be when it was very far from the sun at about 100 astronomical units. And of course, at that distance, there's very little reflected sunlight. So one of the big problems would be at the very end, you know, the normal thing that you would do as you're approaching an object is have optical navigation to refine your trajectory. But at distances that far from the sun, it would be hard to see the thing. So if you're off by a little bit, you'd probably miss. There was another paper that was published by Seligman and Laughlin where they were looking at what sort of a mission would you have to go to the next one, not Oumuamua per se. And there was also a Keck Institute workshop just in October, early November, where, again, we were exploring ideas of what sort of space mission would be ideal for going to these once-in-a-lifetime targets, not just interstellar objects, but, say, a long-period comet, a newly discovered one, because unlike short-period comets, you don't have a well-known orbit. You don't get a lot of lead time. So I think it's entirely possible to get to these things. Just for Oumuamua, the time has come and gone.
How would you do that? Because you have to jump right ahead of everything else, right? Is the thinking that you would, in the future, you'd have to have some sort of agreement where these once-in-a-lifetime things came along, that they could get ahead of other things in the launch schedule?
Probably what you would want to do is have already put in a proposal for such a mission and already have the spacecraft built and ready to go.
Okay.
And, you know, there's ideas about in the future maybe having gateways to stage missions sort of in the Earth-Moon space, and maybe you could have something ready and waiting, but then that's, you'd want to guarantee that you'd have a target. So for long-period comets, you could guarantee that you would have a target because we understand the frequency with which they are discovered. For interstellar objects, with a sample of one, we don't know the frequency at which they're discovered. So such a mission, you know, that's why we, in our Keck study, said that it would be for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity objects, namely either a long-period comet or an interstellar object. And that way you could guarantee a target.
We've only seen one. Why have we only seen one?
Well, it's because we're just now at the right time because, first of all, anything on a long-period comet orbit is moving very fast past the Earth and Sun when it comes to perihelion. So you don't have a very long period to see it. Unlike long-period comets, which typically have a lot of ice, specifically carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, which turns into a gas, becomes very active at very low temperatures. So you start to develop a big tail really far from the sun. Those are easy to see. Oumuamua, which didn't have any apparent gas or dust that was detectable, wasn't easy to see because it was small and it was dark. And so you just don't have lead time on those. So what that means is you have to have a telescopic survey that can see very faint objects very quickly, so that dictates a big telescope, and you have to be looking over a large fraction of the sky all the time. And so we've only recently had all-sky surveys with big telescopes that would be capable of seeing these things. So that's why now.
Do you expect to find any again soon? How often do you think these things come through our solar system?
Well, again, it depends on the statistics. Turns out that Tony Englehart and Rob Jedecky had published a paper in 2017, not too long before Oumuamua was discovered. There they were trying to infer the space density of interstellar objects based on the accumulated grand total of about 19 years worth of surveying, if you added up all the surveys, and the fact that nothing had yet been discovered. And so it had always been expected that the most likely discovery would first be an interstellar comet with a lot of activity, because, first of all, those are the easiest to eject from their home systems, since comets, which have a lot of ice in them, form in the vicinity of the giant planets, and it's the giant planets that can most easily eject things. So based on that, they had a limit that was a little bit low, but they also considered interstellar asteroids without tails, which would be harder to see. And so given that this looked like an interstellar asteroid, their prediction said that effectively at any one moment, there could be an interstellar object between the Earth and the Sun at that distance from the Sun. And of course, that's a more difficult region of the solar system to search, because that means that the telescopes are searching, you know, in the vicinity of the Sun, which they don't do. So that's the hardest place to see them also.
Now it's gone. It's beyond where you can reach it in any way. So you're not going to get any more data on it at all?
No.
It's gone.
No, as of January, you know, our Hubble Space Telescope program, a lot of people asked, why didn't we turn the telescope on Oumuamua immediately? Well, in part, you don't use Hubble unless there's a compelling reason to do so, because it's a precious resource. And the reason to use Hubble is if you can get the superb resolution of space to resolve details, or because you need ultraviolet. And we already knew from the very first measurements that came in from its total brightness that it was very small. And given that, we knew we couldn't resolve it with HST. And then secondly, because there was no activity seen on it, the reason to go to ultraviolet would be to detect OH, which is a breakdown product of water. So we knew that there was no point in going to the UV. So we decided for the Hubble program not to do immediate observations. And the reason that you hesitate for immediacy is that interrupts the entire HST schedule. And it's only to be done, you know, for extremely important things. And we didn't see a need for interruption. So instead we said, we'll use HST because it will get fainter than anything else. And we can follow Oumuamua into January, which will give us the longest possible arc length on its orbit for us to best trace back where it came from. And so our original thought was by having two orbits in November, we could connect that to the data in October and get a good estimate. We knew that its rotation period was about 7 and a bit hours and that it had huge brightness range. And then we thought by December, we'll still be able to see it no matter when we observe it. And then we can connect those 2 months of data together and make a really accurate prediction of when it's at its brightest in early January. Because in early January, then it would be so far from Earth and the Sun that we would only be able to see it at its brightest point in its rotation. But already in November, we had discovered that it wasn't rotating in a simple way. It was in an excited state, which meant there was no way we could predict the brightness in January. So we asked for 4 more orbits so that we could cover the whole rotation period and guarantee that we saw it.
Are there a team of you now who now know that these things are coming into the solar system, who are constantly now on the lookout for them so you can get maximum data next time I mean, you did this time as well, but, you know, to give you that option, make sure you're completely on the lookout for them. Or was it always like that anyway?
It more or less is always like that. We responded as fast as you possibly could, and there's really no change to be made fundamentally to the search programs. You know, in a sense, the near-Earth object survey programs are designed to catch rapidly moving things that are relatively faint, that are close to the Earth, and that's what Oumuamua was. So, you know, we won't be changing the search strategy. The one thing that will be a little bit different was for Oumuamua, the way pan-STARRS worked for the near-Earth objects is they're initially discovered with pan-STARRS, and then Richard Wainscott has a follow-up program on the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope to get further position measurements to determine the orbit. And because the detector array is huge on the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, to speed up the process, they would take this initial observations from pan-STARRS, assume it's a near-Earth object, and then search only the region on the detectors from Canada-France that correspond to orbits for near-Earth objects. And the reason Oumuamua was found was it happened to fall in that part of the detector. So I think now they're searching the whole detector instead of just the preferred region for near-Earth objects. But other than that, I don't think there's been any change. And I'm sure that many teams have proposal text ready to go so that there's not even a few hours delay for putting in proposals when something will be discovered in the future.
Initially, what you thought it'd come from Constellation Lyra, right, from that part of the sky. Is that still the thinking?
Yes, I mean, Constellation of Lyra is huge. And, of course, the whole point of our HST experiment was to track its path homewards. And so after we had discovered that there was this non-gravitational motion, you have to take that into account in its trajectory. And then we also wanted to wait until the Gaia catalog, which data release 2 came out, and Gaia is a space satellite that's making very, very precise measurements of the positions and the velocities of stars. You know, of course, people were excited at first when they heard that it was coming from Lyra, because one of the prominent stars in that constellation, Vega, has a debris disk around it, namely a young solar system that's forming. And so people said, wow, could this be from that disk? But of course, if you trace back in time to when Oumuamua was in that part of the sky, Vega wasn't there because everything's moving. So that's why you needed the really high precision from Gaia, because that gives you really precise velocities and positions. So combining the non-gravitational effect on its orbit and all these precise positions, Corin Baylor-Jones, who had the expertise to do this, reconstructed the orbits of, you know, 7 million Gaia stars and then traced back the path of Oumuamua to compare against these orbits. And he found 4 candidate star systems that could potentially be the home for Oumuamua. And what we did was assumed that Oumuamua's path had to pass within about an Oort cloud radius or 2 of that star system. And so he found 4 candidates, and they were relatively recent. It would have passed by relatively recently, meaning within the last 7 million years or so. The only problem is its relative velocity to each of those star systems was on the order of 10 to 25 kilometers a second. And that's too fast to be an ejection, because a giant planet ejection would be a couple kilometers a second. So we have to throw out those star systems, and it may be that it originated farther away, but right now the Gaia catalog is not accurate enough to trace farther back in time. So maybe as that satellite continues to get more observations and make more high-precision measurements, this experiment can be repeated, reanalyzed, and maybe we'll find more. The problem is the farther back in time you go, the more likely it is to have had another stellar encounter. And once it's had more than one, you can't reconstruct the path at all. One reason we think it's only had one is that it's velocity when it entered the solar system was very similar to all the local neighboring stars, which means it's very likely to have come from something nearby. Because if it hadn't come from nearby, chances would have been it would have interacted with stars, many stars, and each interaction changes its velocity.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you so much for this. It's really, really helpful.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much to Karen for talking to me and for letting me use that interview here on The Cosmic Shed, because that interview was actually done for a feature article that I'm writing for Physics World, which would be, I think, in the February 2019 Physics World magazine, all about Oumuamua. And we'll see you tomorrow for day 14 of The Cosmic Shed Advent Calendar. Thank you for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.